And will you all help me please welcome our speaker tonight, Doug, from the group Working with Others in Netcong, New Jersey.
Thank you.
Good job. Hi, everybody. My name is Doug Peck, and I'm an alcoholic. Because of the grace of God, the actions that I've learned to take in Alcoholics Anonymous, the sponsorship, I haven't had a drink since November 3rd of 1979. I'm really happy about that. And thanks to Frank for riding along with me. It makes the trip a lot more fun when you got another alcoholic hanging out with you. I'm going to tell you why I'm here tonight. But it's going to take about an hour to do that. Simply because why would you go out on a Monday night when it's a little chilly outside, when you have a nice house and I have a nice wife and here I am out in the middle of Pennsylvania on Monday night at 32 degrees talking to people that I just met. Why would I do that? It starts with what happened on November 3rd of 1979. I'm in a car traveling between Manhattan, Kansas, which is where I was pretending like I was going to college, and Lawrence, Kansas. And if you know anything about football, college football, there's K-State, which is where I was at, and KU, which is in Lawrence. And I'm riding over there with my brother-in-law, who loves KU, and I'm a K-State fan, and my sister's with us, and we're driving along, and it's about 10 o'clock in the morning, and I'm having my morning drink, and I was drinking coffee with a little peppermint schnapps mixed in with it, and it was getting me where I wanted to go, because, I'd been seeing a psychiatrist for about 40, 50 days, and psychiatrists have prescribed me some of these funny little pills, and I take those funny little pills and I drink the booze, and it would send me over the top, and I loved it. But he had convinced me in that period of time that what I needed to do is I needed to check into a mental institution. And it wasn't on my list of places to attend, was a mental institution. And so I resisted, and I resisted to the point where, until I reached a point where I could no longer function. I was trying to go to school, but I was flunking out. I was starting to hallucinate. I was hearing things and I was feeling things that didn't exist. And so he convinced me, because I didn't know what else to do. I had reached a point where I didn't know what other thing I could do to possibly do what my philosophy for living before that point in time was that grab yourself by your bootstraps and pull yourself up and keep marching. And that's what I've been trying to do. But this thing called alcoholism, which I didn't understand that I had at the time, I had no willpower. I had no ability to pull myself up by the bootstraps and put myself on a different course, because I'd been trying. I'd been going, besides seeing a psychiatrist, I'd spent a lot of time in the bookstore, especially in the psychology center, buying books about how to fix yourself, and I wasn't getting fixed, because every time that I would get on a pathway to say I'm going to correct the way I do things, and even part of that was I'm not going to drink anymore, I always drank again, and the reason is because of my condition. My condition is that I cannot stay sober without some kind of aid, and I can't stay drunk, because it creates all kinds of problems. So on that morning, we were heading over there, and I'd seen a psychiatrist, and he'd already convinced me I'd go into this nut house, and then I'm on my way over there. I'm hanging out the window. I'm yelling obscenities to the KU fans, and my sister grabbed me by the shoulder, and she pulled me back in the car, and she took the bottle from me, and she says, "You've had enough." And I don't know what was magical about that moment, but I stopped, And I like to think about this because I've heard other people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about, that day is that God entered their lives, because some power entered and took away my desire to drink. Because I then spent the next 10 days laying in bed at my parents' home with access to alcohol, and the thought of drinking didn't come to mind. A lot of other things came to mind. And suicide wasn't one of them because I just didn't have the fortitude to even consider that as an option because of my ego. And my ego says, you know, you could kill yourself, but the problem with killing yourself is that you probably won't be there to see the reaction that you're looking for, you know, which is, oh, look, poor Doug, you know. So that's not an option, and I end up then conceding in those 10 days without thinking about drinking. I check into this mental institution. So let me tell you a little bit about how I got to that date, you know, to where I think I had a spiritual awakening that I really wasn't aware of, but something happened. I started drinking when I was 13. I drank when I was about 8, 9 years old. I come from a family of people that like beer, and at Christmas time, they like kegs of beer. When there's a keg of beer and there's a lot of adults around who are drinking beer, they don't notice what the little kids are doing much, and you could sneak over and get some beer for yourself, and I did. And I loved the effect. I loved the way I just felt happy and just had a lot of fun with that. But didn't really follow that until I got to be age 13. Then at age 13, two things happened. One is that I was old enough now to where I could go to work on my father's farm. And the second thing that happened, that allowed me to start drinking with the men. And I wanted to drink like the men. I wanted to work like the men, and I wanted to drink like the men. And so I started to drink at 13, and I was drinking beer only, this is how, when I look back on that, I know that I'm alcoholic, because when I started drinking, I drank like a pig, you know. I kept pouring it in until I puked, and then I figured out how that after you puked, you could still drink, you know, if you got the bad taste out of your mouth, and if you were drunk enough, you didn't even notice. And after going through that, And here's the other thing I learned too, is that whenever they offered me a beer, and in fact there was one incident where my uncles and my dad and my grandfather, we had six pack of beer, and there was enough for the men, and there was one beer left for myself and my cousin, who we were both 14 years old, and I refused to drink, you know. And the reason I refused to drink, because I know how I drink, so half a beer is not going to be where I want to go. I want to get on board, and I want to get blitzed. And I had no idea that my condition was out. I just thought I liked to drink. And so I go through, I had my first, I had a lot of trouble with drinking and driving. I was never a bar drinker. I was a car drinker. And I ran into a lot of things, and I caused a lot of damage as a result of my drinking and driving. My first accident was I was 14 years old. I'm driving a farm truck, 2-ton farm truck, and my cousin's in the other one. We had a couple beers, and we're going as fast as we can in those old trucks through cornfields, and come around the corner, there's an old farmer there in his car, and I hit him, and demolished the truck and demolished his car and sent him and his wife to the hospital, and it was just bad. You know, I'm 14 years old, and I'm full of guilt and shame, because this kind of thing's not supposed to happen to me, because I was planning on a perfect life, and I dropped my first ball right there. But I got past that, and the thing about it is that this is the state of Kansas, and at the age of 14, you could drive a motor vehicle because you had a learner's permit, and that's all I had, was a learner's permit, and had my first accident. So at the age of 16, I'm in high school, and I've got a bootlegger, and I can get beer anytime I want, and I'm with some friends, and we'd been down to the bootlegger, and we had a case of quarts of Budweiser beer, you know, and we're driving around in my car. An Oldsmobile is like a 442, but two models lower than that. But it ran fairly well. And so I'm in town, and we're drinking the beers, and I got three people in the back seat, and a guy sitting next to me in the front, And I come into town and I think, you know, I'm a little bit of a show off, and I've done a lot of things that I probably shouldn't have done, drive on the school lawn and cut donuts around the flagpole and taken a 1955 Chevy pickup. And so, you know, if you take a 1955 Chevy pickup and you let a little air out of the front tires and you line up with the railroad track, you can just put it in gear and take your hands off the steering wheel, and that baby will go nice and straight for as far as you want to go. I had a guy with me when I was doing that, and I was just having such a good time. I looked over him, and it looked like he was going to pass out because we were on a rail track, and we went over a bridge, and he was pretty concerned about his life at that moment. But those are the kind of things that I engage in. I'm somewhat of a risk taker and thrill seeker. So when I come into that little town, I do this donut, and the local sheriff is sitting in the park in the dark. And we saw him, and he took to chasing us. And I ran out of town going about 100 miles an hour, and my buddies were throwing the beer out the window, and we outran the cop, and I messed up my car because I hit a big old rock on a country road and knocked a hole in the oil pan, and that ended my night. But I was really disappointed because we threw away all the beer because he didn't catch us. But those are the kind of things that I did. So I get through high school, and I had trouble with dating in high school. I'll tell you my dating story. It's very brief. Because my first love was alcohol. I wanted to drink, and it got in the way of everything else. It got in the way of what I thought was the things that I wanted in life were like, you know, I wanted a nice girl, you know, and I wanted a nice car and nice clothes and a nice job and a nice house and all those things that most people desire, you know, to have a comfortable life. And I always got tripped up because the alcohol became more important than those other things. And so there was this one young lady, her name was Barbara. And I really liked Barbara. Barbara's a sweet young thing, 16 years. I was 17 years old. And we go out. But before I go out on a date, what I have to do is I have to get ready. And for me, getting ready was I had a few drinks. I drank quite a few beers before I picked her up. And so I picked her up. And Barbara and I go to this little pub. We call them beer joints where I came from. We go to this beer joint. And they'll serve anybody. If you got money and you can reach the counter, they'll serve you. And I'm there with her and another couple. We're having a couple of beers, and all of a sudden I just puke, and I puked right on Barbara. And needless to say, I didn't get a second date. She was not impressed, and so I had a difficult time in that area because my priority was how can I get another drink. So by the time I'm 17 years old, I graduated from high school when I was 17, 1974, and I had three choices, you know, that I could either head off to the military, I could go to college, or I could stay on that farm and work. And if any of you remember what was going on in the early 70s, the Vietnam War was winding down, and there wasn't going to be as much glory is what I was hoping for by being in the military, and I also heard they gave orders. And I've always had problems with taking direction from other people, and I still do. Part of the story a little bit later is, you know, this little thing inside of me that says all the time, you can't tell me what to do. So college, that was an option. And I'd been up to the college campus close by to where I grew up and where my family lived, and I liked what they did up there. You know, they had kegs of beer. They get these big tubs and they pour all this booze in it and drink it. And they had funny little pills. And I told my dad, you know, that I'd really like to go to college. You know, I that sounds pretty interesting. And he goes, he discriminated against boys because he was willing to pay for my sister's college, but he wouldn't pay for mine. And I just thought that was terrible. But his rationale was that, well, and so this is where the other side of the discrimination comes. They'll never be able to work on the farm. You can. So you can make money. They can't. So if you want to go to college, you're going to have to earn your own money. And I didn't like that idea much. So I took the third option, which is staying on that farm and make money, buy the new car that I was looking for, get some nice clothes, and maybe get me a nice girl. That's what I was shooting for at that point in time, you know, 17 years old. And in October of that year, I turned 18, and I joined the Knights of Columbus. And my father had been in the Knights, my grandfather had been in the Knights of Columbus. I'm joining the Knights of Columbus not because they had joined, or for their reasons for joining. I joined because I found out that, because keep in mind, where I grew up is that it was, they had beer joints, but there were no saloons, meaning that you couldn't walk into a place and buy a hard drink. You could get a package, but you couldn't buy a hard drink, unless you belonged to a club. And Knights of Columbus were considered to be a club. So I joined the Knights of Columbus, and for that very reason, is because it was the only place on a Sunday afternoon at the age of 18 that if I wanted to, I could get a whiskey sour. And that's what I wanted. I wanted a whiskey sour. I'd gone from drinking beer to finding out about the hard liquor, and I'm kind of liking the hard liquor. And so me and my buddies, we start running together, and we end up at that Knights of Columbus on a pretty regular basis as the winter months settle in because farming slows down. And we're going to that club and playing poker and drinking whiskey. And what we would do at the end of that night is we'd get in our cars and we'd race over to the next town. I mean race, you know, 25 minutes away and go into the, get a bite to eat. So in February of 1979, we're doing the same thing and I'm driving and we're going, we're doing what we typically do. I'm going 100, 110 miles an hour. And I got my buddy sitting next to me and I lost control of the car. You know, and the reason I lost control of the car is because it was an extremely windy night that night. And I came to a bridge where it was elevated, almost like a ramp, and the car went up. And when it came back down, it did not come back down straight. It came back on the front of my tire and tumbled in over in, and the engine was thrown from the car. My buddy was thrown from the car, and it rolled over the top and killed him. And they came and pulled me from the inside of that car and walked me over to the ambulance, and they put me in the hospital for about 3 days. And my parents, I remember the anguish, you know, as drunk as I was, I remember the anguish of my mother, how it just, one more time I had torn her heart apart because of my actions. And knowing that I had also torn another mother's heart apart as well, became a reality. And so my drinking at the age of 18 took a shift. And the way it shifted was this way, is that now I had done something. Because see, up to that point, everything that I'd ever done in my life, I could somehow undo. You know, I couldn't undo this. And so I'm trying to live in a world where my philosophy for living is grab yourself by your bootstraps, pull yourself up, and keep walking. And when you live like that, I found, and you don't talk to people about what's going on, you just become a cesspool. You become cut off from other people, and I was surely cut off from God. So I was faced with vehicular homicide. I was scared to death. I decided that what I would do is I would try to go to college. And you know what, this is where, you know, the old alcoholic trying to get the monkey off his back. I can't stand here and tell you that I was my motives were pure. My motive was, you know, I want the judge to think that I'm a good kid. Because I had really long curly hair and it was a bush. And, you know, I cut my hair short and I'm waiting, you know, to go in front of the judge. And I go to college thinking, you know, if I'm showing them that I'm doing something positive here, they'll cut me a break and they won't send me to the penitentiary, which is what I'm worried to death that I'm going to the penitentiary. Because I'm 18 years old. And I go to college and the first semester runs by and I do fairly well because I'm not drinking as much. In the book it talks about, you know, fear sobered us for a while, and I was sobered for a little while. And January rolls around and it turns out that they decided, and when I say they, back then, the family had a lot of input as to what happened. And the family determined that they didn't want to press charges. That they made a settlement with the insurance company. And so here's what happened to me as a result of that. It's like I'm going, the monkey's off my back. you know, I can start to drink again. And I did. And what was amazing is that that first night that I drank, it was like I thought maybe because it had been a while since I drank that I'd have some tolerance here. I had absolutely no tolerance whatsoever. I was drunk in a minute. And it just got continuing to get worse as far as the, you know, the consumption of alcohol. And by the end of that next semester, I flunked out, because I wasn't paying attention. I got back to focus on what I wanted to do more than anything else, which was drink. And I would drink. But I'm still walking around, trying to pull myself up on my bootstraps, trying to figure out what my solution is to my problems. And full of self-pity. So I do that for about a year and a half, and when I flunked out of college, I went back to the farm, and I'm working on the farm, and things get worse there, and I start getting into physical fights with some of my family members, and I decided I'm going to go to college. I moved to Manhattan, Kansas, and one of the things, you know, because of that car accident, I had made a declaration, a promise, whatever you want to call it, that I was never going to harm someone else again because of my drinking and driving, that I was going to stop that. And so I ended up in Manhattan, Kansas, and with this thought in mind, is that I'm going to move there, and I'm going to stay away from the drinking, because I know there's a correlation to my problems and my drinking. You know, but I don't think I'm an alcoholic, but I just knew that if I could just moderate, you know, drink on the weekends. So I start working in this lumber yard, and when I get to this lumber yard, after we clocked out at the end of the first day that I'm there, they bring out a case of Budweiser. And it was just like that. You know, I started to drink again. And while I was there, probably 9 months, and in that period of time, you know, I was raised in the Catholic Church, and had belief in the Ten Commandments, and was trying to live by those, and I'm breaking every one of them. And when I get to this place, I finish it off for the most part, and that is, you know, I'm stealing from my employer. I was sleeping with somebody that was married, and all those things. What they do when you're not drinking, it just builds fear in your life. Now I'm looking over my shoulder, wondering when they're going to, you know, when's he going to find out and come looking for me, her husband, you know. When's the boss going to find out I've been stealing from him? And I stayed there for about 9 months, and I went back to college, and one more time I flunk out. And I finally started to get things going fairly well in the fall of 1978, and I'm back in college again. First semester goes fairly well. On by this time, I've moved up to, because when I drink, I don't know about you guys, when I go into a liquor store and I look for something to drink, I don't look at the brands. I look at the alcohol content. You know, what's going to get me there the quickest? And I found Bacardi rum. You know, a 181. I'm going, that's my stuff. You know, and that's the stuff that I remember. I remember drinking one Halloween. I had this long trench coat and my black horn-rimmed glasses, a little top hat, and not a top hat, but one of those hats the guys wore in the 50s. And I looked like Clark Kent. You know, and I had a pint in each pocket, and I'm walking, and I go to this party, and then when the party's over, there's nothing in my pockets, but I can't stay on the sidewalk. I am so intoxicated. But that's just, I drank until I couldn't drink anymore. So I end that semester, and things have gone fairly well. I'm making progress because I'm not drinking as much. I'm trying to be studious, make something of myself. Coming into the semester, I did fairly well, and I decided, well, I'm going to go to a party. And I go to a party, and again, my two pints in my pocket, and I'm getting ready to leave, and the hostess, very conscientious woman, said to me, she says, why don't you let us give you a ride home? And you ever tell an alcoholic that he can't drive? I said, I'm fine. I'm fine. So I get in my car and I take off to go to my apartment. And on my way to my apartment, I'm so drunk that I miss my turn. So I circle back around to go back to where my apartment is. And as I'm headed towards that, there's a stop sign. And this is where that little comes in. I looked at that stop sign, and this is a thought that went through my head just before I ran through that intersection. I said, you can't tell me what to do. And I just F-U'd, and I went through that thing, and I clobbered a car. I T-boned. And so here I am. It's a little less than 3 years from the time my friend died in that car accident. And I just broke another one of the promises that I made myself that I wasn't going to ever be in a set of circumstances where someone's harmed as a result of my drinking and driving. And it just had happened. And here's the thing that I did is that, you know, the police officer comes because it just seems that whenever I'm drunk and in a car wreck, I walk away. And he comes over and opens up the door and asked me to get out. And I was, in the back of my head, somebody told me, said, if you're ever in a tight spot with a cop, tell them that, you know, you're hurt and that you want to go to the hospital. And then they can't take you down to the jailhouse. So that's what I told him. He says, okay. He says, get in my car. He put me in my car and he took me down to the jailhouse. And then they interrogated me and I did it. And part of me wishes that I could see that if there would have been video back then to see how much of a jerk I was that night, because I was a terrible jerk to those police officers. I jerked them around. I jerked my roommate around. I finally just said, F you to everybody. I said, I'm spending the night in jail. And then they said, no problem. And I spent the night in jail. And I paid my little fine, and I got back out on the street. When I got out on the street, you know, I had some problems. You know, now I got a DUI. So I go to court in January, and my attorney, my father, got me an attorney because he wanted me to retain my license so I could go home and drive truck in the summer. When the attorney called me, he says, listen, I read your arrest report. He says, you ain't got no chance. He says, you just will go and plead out. And that's what I did. And the judge sends me to 6 months in jail, suspended it to, or I'm sorry, 30 days in jail, suspended to 6 months probation. But the lawyer told me, he says, listen, buddy, he says, my mother died of alcoholism. He says, I believe you're an alcoholic. And he says, I think you should go and get some help somewhere for the problems that you're having. And he wanted me to go off to this place called Valley Hope, which is a big treatment center out in that area. And I thought, I'm not that bad. You know, I will go get some help on this campus. And I got a probation officer and it was great. And I got the psychiatrist the problem with psychiatrists is their patients. And what I mean by that is that I never told them the truth. You know, I told them part of the truth. I told them how terrible my family was. I never told them how terrible I was. And so he was, you know, he was convinced that what I should do is I needed to go home and express my anger to my family, which I'm glad I never followed up on. And the probation officer, she was really nice. And, you know, 90 days later, I get another driver's license and I get another car. And here's what goes on in my head. Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm not going to drink and drive anymore. Still going to drink, I'm still going to drive, but I'm not going to do the two together. And that works until about next Tuesday. And then next Tuesday rolls around, and I'm going, well, because I have a little drink and I drive. And I say, okay, all right, I'll drink and I'll drive, but I'll drive the speed limit. That was my next goal. The next thing you know, I'm doing what I typically do. I'm drinking, I'm driving, and I'm driving as fast as I can. I had this thing about driving fast. And I still do. You should ask my wife. You know, she thinks I drive too fast. But it was just, you can't combine those two together. The only thing I got smart about is I didn't put anybody in the car with me, which we know it really doesn't matter because you run into other people. But before things got, before another accident happened, I started to come undone. And I'm home that summer of 1979, and I'm working on the farm and helping my dad and uncles cut, you know, harvest the wheat. And I really got a bad attitude. And my uncle comes up to me and he goes, he says, "Hey, boy, you know what's wrong with you?" And I said, "No, what?" No, I was offended by the fact that he called me boy. I was 22. Come on. And he says, "You need an oophorectomy." And I'm going, "What's an oophorectomy?" He says, "That's when they go in and they cut the cord that runs between your eyeball and your asshole and gets rid of your crappy outlook on life." And the problem with that statement was I knew it was true. So I end up back at that college one more time, and I'm seeing a psychiatrist, and this is where we come back to that November 3rd of 1979. I'm seeing a psychiatrist, and he's prescribing pills, and he's asking me when I take the pills how they work. And I tell him, I says, they seem to work fairly well except when I drink. When I drink and take the pills, I start to cry a lot. And I loved his advice. He said, "Why don't you, if you're going to drink, don't take the pills. And if you take the pills, don't drink." And I said, "It's a good idea, Doc." And I went home and I drank and I took the pills. Because that's what I do, is I overindulge in everything. And so November 3rd, 1970, I'm in that car and my sister takes a drink away and I stop. And so now begins my journey of recovery at this point in time. And I didn't know it. I checked into that hospital, I think around November 14th in 79, and I met a man, his name was Ted, and Ted had been sober 23 years, and I am 23 years old at that time, and I'm going, how does a guy not drink for 23 years? And so I was real interested in what he had done. And he was a farmer, and then he was raised in the same religion I was raised in. So there was a tremendous connection that occurred. And that's what I believe about God, is that God puts in our lives people that we can identify with, because that's, I think, critical for us to make a connection and want to stick around here. Because he was like me, and I was like him. So what Ted does, because I open up to him, I tell him, I tell him about the car wrecks and the problems at home and problems with girlfriends and money problems. And he says, "Well, I want you to get into this program called substance abuse treatment." And so I went into that thing and I'm in there. And I'm there for the duration of my stay. And I stay there till the end of December, first week of January. And during that period of time, I was exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was exposed to the 12 steps. We had people that would bring a meeting in from the outside on a Tuesday, and I didn't like it. I didn't like that meetings because I didn't like the people that were in there. There was a guy that had been in the penitentiary and he had tattoos. This is before tattoos were hot around here. And it was a tattoo of a naked woman, and I'm going, I'm a good Catholic boy. I don't hang out with people like this. And then there was another guy that had just gotten out of the penitentiary for rape. I'm going, I really don't hang out with guys like that. And then there was a couple there. They both had these little green beret hats on. They looked like leprechauns. And I'm going, I don't hang out with those people. So I judged Alcoholics Anonymous by the appearance of the people in the room. And so I didn't go to another A meeting until the day that they had me walk out of that institution. I think it was January 8th of 1980, and I walked out of the institution, and what I knew at that point is, because I'd asked Ted, I says, "Ted, tell me what I have to do to never come back here again." Because for me, and I believe it's about everybody that's in Alcoholics Anonymous that comes and stays, is that they have a moment of desperation that just stands out above everything else. And when you have that, and I had that, it's like, I'll do whatever you tell me to do because I just can't go back to what I was doing before. I don't have any other plans. And so I said, I wasn't interested in going to AA to stop drinking. I was going to AA to stay out of the nut house. And he told me, he says, "Listen, here's what you got to do." He says, "You need to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You need to get a sponsor. And you need to work steps to that sponsor." He says, "You do those three things." He says, "I will guarantee you will never be back here." as an inpatient. We would like to invite you to come back and help other people if you would at some point in time. And I want you to know that guy told me the absolute truth. Because I've been doing that ever since, and I haven't been back to a mental institution, except once in a while, you know, to carry the message in there. So I get out of this place, and it's around January 8th, and I'm scared. Because Ted talked me into it. He says, don't go home. He says, you need to get an apartment in this town, you need to get a job in this town, you need to stay close by, because if you go back to either college or to the farm, he says, you're going to drink again. And like I said, I was desperate, and I signed up. And so I'm there, and I'm in this little apartment, and it's Friday night, and I'm looking down the street, and I see the Budweiser sign flashing, you know, the neon sign, and I'm thinking about it. But when I was in that place, these guys gave me this list of numbers to call. And back in 1980, there weren't cell phones, obviously, and not a lot of people had answering machines as well. So I'm going down a list, you know, and I get to the bottom. And this guy, Ralph, the guy that had been in the penitentiary for rape, he picked up the phone. And he came and he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous outside of that institution. And he saved my life. Because I was afraid to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what to expect. You know, I had all kinds of notions that, you know, that it was some kind of a cult. That's, you know, things were going to happen beyond my control. And he took me, got me a cup of coffee, set me down at the meeting. And I felt connected. Didn't know what that was, but I felt connected. And so got very active in that group. Within 6 months of the group, I became the GSR of the group. Let me tell you about my sponsor first. Is that I did get a sponsor as well, and I started working steps to that sponsor. And what happened is that in the area where I sobered up, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous was kind of a reference book. Everybody was using the 12 and 12 as the mechanism for staying. So working with the 12 and 12, trying to work these steps And I look back on this, I'm going, this is just really amazing, because he would call me up and he says, well, how are you doing with step one? I said, I got it. And he goes, how about steps two and three? I says, done. And I says, okay. He says, now, why don't you write your inventory? So I took about 9 months, and I finally wrote my inventory, because he threatened to, you know, he told me, he says, listen, if you don't want to do it, that's fine. You know, you can get somebody else to do it or not do it at all. It's up. And it scared me, because I'm going, he's about to reject me. And so I got busy, and I finished my inventory real quickly. I went over to his house, and I told him every disgusting thing there was that I, as I saw it, you know, the things that I was planning on taking to the grave with me, the things that I wouldn't tell a Catholic priest, the things that I wouldn't tell a psychiatrist. I told about a 44-year-old railroad engineer. You know, because that's what his occupation was. And some of the things that I told him, he had a really beautiful wife and a beautiful young daughter. And I thought for sure when he got done listening to me, he was going to tell me to get out of his house. Because I thought they were disgusting things. And he didn't accept me. He let me stay. And he, you know, when we got to step five, here's what happened to me. Is that, as you know, after step five, there's six, seven, eight, and then nine. And I wanted to avoid nine because of that car wreck. I didn't want to go back and have to make amends for the harm, because I didn't know how to do that. And I wasn't willing to ask anybody how to do that. That was still in that mindset. You know, I came in with a lot of old ideas that I wasn't doing that. So what I did is I skipped from five to 12. And I started sponsoring guys in the group that I was in, and what I would do is I'd take them to step five, and then I'm going, you're on your own. I have no idea what to do. You know. So I get involved with that group, and this is how I stay sober for the first 3.5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I got active in a group, and I I would encourage anybody who doesn't want to work steps is to get busy with service, you know, until you're ready to work steps, because that's what happened to me. So I finally got ready to work steps. I'm sober 3.5 years. And what had happened in those 3.5 years is that, you know, I knew I was really uncomfortable on the inside, and I didn't understand why. And I thought maybe a relationship would fix that. And so I did find and marry someone, and we moved back to Manhattan, Kansas. And as a, when we moved, my sponsor at the time said, listen, you know, you need to get somebody close by. So then I asked a guy that I was watching when I was going to these meetings in Manhattan, Kansas. And what was interesting about him, from my perspective, is that he was very active. And he seemed to be the guy that everybody went to find out, you know, what do I do about this? What do I do about that? So I asked him. And what he says, well, he says, get your big book. He says, come over, and we're going to go through this thing. And but he gave me a reading assignment. My sponsor is one. We didn't sit and read the book together. He says, go read this, and then we'll talk about it. And I go to his house, and we talked about steps 1 and 2. And then we got to step 3, and he did something that my first sponsor had not done. And he had me get on my knees in his basement and say the prayer that's in the book with him. And it scared me to death, because I have always, like I said, I always thought that there was some kind of cult here, some kind of inner circle of people. And I thought, this must be the day when they're going to come out of the closet. You know, and they're going to be wearing long black robes, and they're going to have Bibles. And my parents will never see me again. But that didn't happen. What happened was this, is he says, now go home and write your inventory. And I went back and I wrote that inventory, and it was my second inventory and my last inventory, and that was, it was very precise and concise, because I finally got past, let me tell you all my tales of woe. In my first inventory, I told you how terrible the world had treated me. In my second inventory, I talked about how I treated the world and where my faults were and what I needed to do to make it right. And I went back and I talked to that sponsor about it, and we went through step 5, and then we went on step 6 and 7. He got me on my knees again with a 7-step prayer. And here's what happened between that 3rd step and that 7th step. Is I started to trust another man. I knew that what he cared about was helping me. He wasn't cared about anything else. He just wanted to pass on the message that had been passed on to him. So when we got down to 7, we got to step 8. And I went home and I made a list, and there was a few things I'd forgotten on my inventory that 8-step caught. And I sat with him, and we went through that list, and we began that process of me going back. I went back and I paid the employer back the money that I'd stole from him. He told me, you know, I couldn't go back and talk to the husband or the wife. He said, you know, that's dangerous, and it's not spiritual by any means, because you're going to create more harm if you do that. And a few other things, you know, that were on my list. But the big thing was that you know, what do I do with this family? And so sober 5 years, I make a trip out to where these folks live, and I go to the little banker, and I asked him if he could arrange a meeting, and he arranged a meeting. We went, and we met. I went to his house. They picked me up, and they put me in their RV. And the mother would not go along, but the father and the brother went along, and they put me in this RV, and they took me out in the middle of this big mile field. And I thought, this is it. You know, they got shovels in the back here, and they're going to finish me off. And it didn't go like that at all. It was they were very forgiving people. And I don't know, the only thing I could tell them is to listen, I can't bring your son back. But what I want to do for the rest of my life is stay in Alcoholics Anonymous and try to help other people. That's the best I can do. Again, they were forgiving. And I left there. And I started sponsoring guys. And when we got to step 5, I took them on to 6 and 7, 8 and 9, 10, 11, and 12. And you know why? Because of what it says in the back of the big, or in the, at the end of the, on page 164, you cannot transmit something you do not have. And I got something. You know, something had started to happen. I had a message. And I went through a lot of years with the message where I think that I was very mechanical, technical, and how I delivered that. And I know, looking back on that, it was very much ego-driven. But I still had some undone business with that car accident. And I made many a trip to his grave site in looking for some peace with that. Late 97, 98, late 90s, couple things happened that were big, and one of them was that my marriage fell apart. And the other thing is my home group split. I was doing okay on the work front, but the other areas of my life were kind of disheveled. And I take this trip in December of 1999 back out to the great state of Kansas, and I go to the gravesite one more time. And this time, I have a mission. It's that I'm going to go and I'm going to look for... This is the critical part that I forgot to mention early on, is that when I was laying in that hospital bed when I was 18 years old, this guy came into my room, and he was 26 at the time, or 25 or 26, and his name was Gary, and he says, your car landed on my property. And he said, I wanted to come and see if there's anything I could do to help you with. And he said, he started talking to me about Jesus. And I'm going, not Jesus. I can't handle Jesus right now. And I dismissed him. So on this, in 1999, we do jump ahead from 1975 to 1999, and I'm going to his house. And the reason I'm going to his house is because I want him to know that his visit wasn't in vain. And I got to his house, and here's what had happened. He had just left, and so his wife was there, and I sat down with her, and I told her why I was there and what I was trying to do, and she said, well, let me tell you from our point of view what happened that night. She said, because you affected our family on our side, and you probably don't realize how you had done that. And she said, on that same corner many years ago, one of our siblings had been killed. And when that happened, our family was torn apart. He says, the night of your accident, our family came back together. I don't know if you believe that, but it healed me. Those words healed me. Because I walked away from there, and I came back home, and I got this book. And big revelation as a result of that discussion. And it's on page 62. This is the how and why. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. And see, here's what I had done. When I was in that hospital room when I was 18 years old, I had made a decision. The decision was this, is that I don't deserve to be happy because somebody else lost their life as a result of my actions. And when I went and I saw that family, and they said, well, there's another perspective of this. I'm going, damn, I'm self-centered, you know. And the day that happened, I had gone to an AA meeting in that morning, and I ran to this guy by name Bob. And Bob was notorious for quoting the Bible, you know, almost obnoxious. But I like Bob. And so I was telling Bob my tale of woe, and he said something to me that became relevant after I visited this lady. He says, just remember, he says, all things work for the good of God. And I met with her, and life shifted. It shifted dramatically for me when I came back to this page. Because it also says this at the end of this. It says, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. And the remarkable things weren't on the outside. The remarkable things were on the inside. It was the peace that came with that. And there's more work to do. And that's why I continue to be active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I met a really nice lady in late 1999. And she was a widow. And we got married in 2005. And she had three kids. And so I get to be a stepfather, and I was trying to think of something funny to say about that, but nothing came. And participate in that family, and more importantly, or as importantly, is that when I came back from that in 2000, I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I fell in love with the people that I was sponsoring. I began to feel that connection that I feel every time I come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous now. It's the connection that I would feel when I would take a drink. Because when I would take a few drinks, you know, I would feel like I felt good, you know. And I cared about people a little bit, you know. But anyway, life was a lot easier when I was taking a few drinks. But the problem is that I always exceed the mark, and I'd be drunk again. But Alcoholics Anonymous does exactly the same thing that alcohol does. It just takes a little bit longer for it to happen. And it's through that persistency. You know, you think about the cancer patient, and he or she is diagnosed with cancer, and what happens is the doctor prescribes a treatment for that, and they go for the treatments, and after the treatments are completed and they're healthy again, what they can do is just periodically go back to the doctor for checkups. With alcoholics, with alcoholism, it's like when you're diagnosed with a problem, it takes persistent effort in order to stay here. You got to keep doing this thing. And I keep doing it because of that connection that I've discovered. See, I'm when I think about step 11, conscious contact with God, because I came here with a whole bunch of old ideas of what that meant. My old ideas was, and I remember reading the Big Book, and they were talking about God and stuff like that, and the old ideas would dart in and say, yeah, he's going to get me, you know, because that's what they told me. No, I'm sorry. That's what I heard, that God's going to get me, and I've been waiting for him to get me, and I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he got me, you know, but he got me in a different way. You know, I'm buying in. I'm buying into the philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous as a way of life. You know, and the reason is because I'm experiencing the same level of ease and comfort that used to come with a few drinks. You know, I'm experiencing peace of mind. I have a relationship with the God of my understanding. You know, I pray to that God on a throughout the day. You know, I've come up with this little plan now that it goes like this: that when I'm having difficulty at work, I simply say, "Why don't you bring God into this? You know, let Him be a partner." You know, let him be a part of what's going on. And as a result of that, I usually have pretty good days. So I really am appreciative, Mike, for asking me to come out tonight and share with you guys. I didn't see anybody fall asleep, so I appreciate that too. Thanks.